Greetings, you beautiful humans. This is Glenn Klein online for Wednesday, October 11, 2006. The only October 11, 2006 in the history of humanity. Let us continue to make it a great one. Welcome in on this Wednesday evening. We are so happy to have Michael Williams back with us, the Gospel Revolution. Michael, happy Wednesday to you.
Thank you, Glenn, and to you too, and our listeners.
We're coming to you live from the Glenn Klein Online Studios in Tampa Bay, Florida. Michael, you're pretty alive, aren't you, Michael?
I think I am.
Pretty live from his offices in the great state of Illinois, the land of Lincoln. We're coming to you tonight after a major incident in New York City today, where a small plane with a pitcher from the New York Yankees, Corey Lytle, crashed into a 50-story condominium tower on Manhattan's Upper East Side, killing two people and raining flaming debris on sidewalks. And of course, Michael, this brings home the memories of 9/11 and also other tragedies that people experience. And I often think about how people cope with these kind of incidents in their lives, or things that bring either their own mortality to the forefront of their minds, or memories of lost loved ones. And when you know that everyone, including Corey Lytle of the New York Yankees, is at peace with God, Paul called this the hope that lives within.
Yes, that is true. You know, it's always sad to know that a husband, a father, you know, a son, or anyone has died, especially in a tragic incident. You know, sometimes it's better for the individual, but sometimes with a sickness, at least you get the chance to say what you want to say, and unless you're in denial, trying to think that the inevitable is not going to happen. But it is. It's difficult to know that so many people in, you know, civilized countries where supposedly the gospel has been preached for so long, and the exporter of the gospels around the world, and they don't even know the most basic truth, to be able to comfort people in a time like this, because it's a great, great comfort to realize that not only did they not have to believe, they didn't have to believe good enough. You know, it's amazing how we can always question someone's the integrity of their belief until they're dead, or the integrity of their obedience until they're dead. And you know, we all are. You know, I've said this before, Glenn, that there's something wrong when our hearts are kinder than our doctrine. And when your own heart wants to let somebody into heaven in a kinder way than what your doctrine will, there's something wrong when man's heart is kinder, more gracious, and more merciful than God himself.
To what degree do you think that people's doctrines affect their hearts and vice versa?
Well, I think much more profoundly than suspected, that any of us may suspect. I can only measure what has happened in my heart between the difference between where I was in believing a completely legalistic doctrine. It was a positive legalistic doctrine, but nonetheless, it was completely legalistic in Word of Faith charismatic movement, and before that, Baptist. And I know where my heart was. I know the guilt and the judgments, and you'll hear me say it. I'll say it a million times. The most devastating consequence of legalism is guilt and judgment, and the most amazing relief of the gospel is freedom from guilt and the freedom of judgment. And guilt is so guides your destiny, and judgment guides your destiny in such a way that, and even if it didn't guide your destiny, the ability to handle things is completely different from being having a heart that is not stabilized by the grace of God when difficulty strikes. And difficulty is going to hit all of us. Tragedy is going to hit all of us, regardless of who we are. We may not die young, we may not die middle-aged, we may die old, but, you know, it's going to happen to all of us. And such an absolute thing with such a marginal, anemic, inconsistent gospel being preached in the areas even where the gospel is preached, it sure doesn't hold a lot of hope, you know. And
And after 9/11, you'll remember that some of the evangelical preachers like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson came out and basically said it was the sin of the United States, and specifically New York City, that had allowed those planes to go into those buildings. And it was after the initial shock of the attacks that week, but there was an uproar because their doctrine did not line up with the vast majority of hearts of the American people, and for that matter, people around the world. They had to back off that.
Yeah, you know, and that's the thing is that even tragedy tries its best. It's the end result of tragedy. Its attempt is, if it had an animate being, you'd say that its attempt is to unify us. And, you know, to bring us back from the ledges, you know, I remember the Amy Grant song, you know, that talks about the gospel that she said, bring us back from the ledges and help us back off from the edges and bring us back to our senses. And it seems like that after 9/11 that the whole world seemed to be one. And you know, it's amazing that a tragedy could give us a sense of oneness and not bring into that the concept of the cross, which was the one event in the world that unified man in such a profound way. But you know, it's really strange how that all came down. I remember that, and everybody was feeling this sense of camaraderie and oneness, and then this sharp, shattered glass, piercing sounds coming from the evangelical right. Mr. Graham, Billy's son and his daughter and others also on the news broadcast talking about how many of those people went straight to hell. That
right.
They knew that 70-80% of those people in those buildings went to hell. And it did. Everybody's heart knew something was wrong with that, you know. But the brashness of being able to say something like that could only take a legalistic heart. And I'm not saying that to say that the Grahams have mean hearts. But religion and legalism is mean, and it'll take the kindest people, which I believe the Grahams to be, the kindest people, the most compassionate people on earth, and turn them into the cruelest acting people on the face of the earth.
Well, and this is also where the hatred, if you will, comes from the left segment of our society, because people who don't believe that, don't believe in the evangelical doctrine, remember those statements.
And oh, absolutely.
And, you know, a huge percentage of the people that were killed that day were Jewish people. And as a Jewish person myself, I know that a disproportionate number of those on the left and in the so-called liberal media are of Jewish descent, and they take that very, very offensively. And a lot of the animus towards the Christian right comes from those memories of when you have loved ones die. And the bottom line is that if evangelical doctrine is right, 99.9999% of those that perish in the Holocaust went from Hitler's ovens to a much worse situation in a so-called hell. I mean, how do you square that with a God of love, a Christian God of love? It makes no sense at all.
No, and usually, of course, the question is, you know, we got over the years as we were breaking through the legalism in the church and still speaking in some of the churches and some of the violent behavior we saw in response to it. And the one was the most violent that was asked questions in the most violent way was about Hitler. And that's the thing that they didn't stop and take into consideration, was that they were so believing that Hitler himself could not possibly be in heaven, but the creator of heaven and earth, could sentence those people not to just a short-term burning in an oven, but an eternal burning, and find something better than Hitler in him. It really is, I think it really does come down to a lot of mental illness that is in people. Our mental institutions are full. And the fact of it is that the vast majority of the people in our mental institutions in America are professing, believing Christians.
Yeah, so we just got an email that deals with this subject exactly. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Glenn Klein Online, and we're taking your email questions at webcast@gospelrevolution.com. Webcast@gospelrevolution.com. Get online and email us your questions this evening. We will get to all of them before the end of the evening, Lord willing. And if the creek don't rise, this comes from Lawrence in British Columbia, Michael. He says that, I just lost it here, but I will get it. He said he worked in mental health for 11 years, and he says that he's heard you mention in your teachings that 70-80% of patients in mental institutions are or have been raised born-again Christian, and he says that is absolutely accurate. As somebody that was in the mental health industry for 11 years, he says when you get all past all the psychobabble from the psychiatrist and really get to know these folks, you find there's almost always some screwed-up religious theme running through their heads along the lines of, I'm not good enough, if only I'd done that right, if only I'd stopped doing this or that, and so on and so on. In other words, they've had the law so ingrained into them, and their minds are now so far gone, few, if any, will ever return to sanity. When you hear someone say religion kills, believe it. It really does kill, and it really does destroy lives. But he says, praise be to God, though, that these precious souls will one day be set free from their tormented minds and bodies and experience the pure love of the one who loved them first. And again, that's from Lawrence in British Columbia.
Yeah, and if Lawrence is the gentleman I'm thinking of, I'm quite sure it is, he's... his own life was profoundly impacted by the gospel, and I remember, sitting and talking on several occasions, and when you've seen it, you not only experienced it, but you've seen it firsthand. The pain and the torment, and of course, we're talking about the people who actually checked into the mental institution, and not those
right.
who are staying at home self-medicating, and the whole. The law creates division. It will divide whatever it comes into, and if it goes into a human being, Glenn, it will divide that human being right down the middle. The law divides one thing from the other, and and here we are trying so hard to get men's souls saved, not their spirit. They're redeemed by the power of Jesus Christ. And yet here comes, and they've already been redeemed, and the communication of the gospel takes the truth that is absolute spiritual fact and communicates that to the mind and to the heart, to the will and the emotions of the human being. But the amazing thing about it is, Glenn, is that it doesn't make any difference what you believe, we're all no matter how legalistic a person is, they are still redeemed by the blood of Jesus Christ. They're as righteous and holy as any one of us are. It doesn't make any difference. The spectrum was brought to a level playing field 2,000 years ago. But you see, the introduction of grace to any human being, because every human being has been redeemed, begins to translate spiritual truth to the heart and to the mind. And I've said this many times, that my job as a teacher is so easy because, Glenn, I'm not trying to get truth into people. I'm trying to get it out of them because I am absolutely convinced that this is intuitive truth that has dwelt inside of them ever since their DNA was put together. And I believe it is an integral part of every human being. But what I'm wanting to communicate is that as we share the gospel, this connects from that spirit man that is absolutely perfect and that part of them that is eternal and begins to communicate to that part of them that is temporal And that part, that the soulless realm that connects to the human world, and the mind which connects to the human world, and it translates from spirit to heart and mind, and causes the heart and mind to see the world from the spirit perspective.
Right.
Now, whenever the law comes in, though, it divides the spirit from the soul and trains the soul and the mind to be in opposition. That's what Paul is talking about, that the carnal mind is hostile against God. The term was enmity that I think he used in Romans. And he said the carnal mind, now carnal, the term carnal, carnality, is not a person having a dirty thought or you know, wanting to play cards or, you know, go out and dance. The carnal mind is one that is under the law, because that's what Paul said, I was carnal man, sold under sin, under the law. So the carnal mind is that which is dominated by legalism and law. And Glenn, that law creates a divided person, and actually you'd probably say a dual person. And that's the reason I say that when a person finds that there's something in them that's kinder than their doctrine, that is inside of you is far superior to your doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
And what we are calling people to is a conversion that Paul had. We're calling people to submit to the Lord Jesus Christ. We're calling people to submit to his lordship, to submit their lives to his obedience. And by doing so, then the revelation of truth that comes to the mind and to the heart makes you one human being. You, God, your heart, your mind, all become stabilized in truth. The law has never done that for a human being. The law has never, ever done that for a human being, especially on this side of the cross, because it is contrary. And Paul makes the statement that which is of the law is not of faith. We know faith is a spiritual issue. The law is spiritual, but it is something that is applied not to the spirit. It is applied to the carnal part of man. And that's the reason that it's important. It's vitally important. The teaching, not of just the gospel of freedom from the law, the Mosaic law and the Ten Commandments, but it's vitally important to teach people the redemption of the world to the point where that the requirement for belief has also been done away with, and that believing becomes a privilege. And as we said in the last broadcast, every degree that a person experiences their spirituality based on their performance or their belief, that's the degree of self-righteousness that will exist, therefore resulting in the degree of guilt and judgment that exists, which all psychiatrists and psychologists, and as Lawrence can tell you from working in the industry, leads to mental and emotional instability.
But some people would say, Michael, that who is to judge what kindness is in one's heart, and that if people are destined to spend eternity in hell, that it would be the most kind thing in the world to say, no, you're not forgiven by God without belief. You must have faith. This is what the Bible says. This is true kindness. Look at the kind of kindness that Christ manifested in the temple when he called the religious leaders, the rulers of the day, vipers and snakes, that this is the kind of kindness that is necessary in order to get people saved.
Yes, and I do agree with that, that kindness is letting people know the truth. The question is it the truth? Now, if the fact that people were vipers and snakes who needed to come and through their belief become righteous and holy, then I would be preaching that. But, Glenn, after all of those years of indoctrination that, first off, certainly gave me no peace of mind. It gave me peace with the group I was in, but it didn't give me peace of mind with God. I stayed in a constant flux of thinking I was okay, thinking I wasn't okay. But I do agree that if the truth is you are headed toward a cliff and you're about to go off of that cliff, that it is true that saying the truth to somebody instead of soothing them is the thing to do, is to let them know you're going to go over a cliff.
Right.
Warning, the end is near. And that is the kindest thing. But it is equally cruel to tell people that they are headed toward a cliff that is not there.
Right.
That they're about to go off of over an edge that doesn't exist, and create in people's hearts and minds fears that are not even real. And that's the way the Christian life is lived out. Not just the Christian life, but a great deal of people in the world, because of the... I just believe in the gospel, Glenn. I believe the gospel answers the heart's cry for stability of mind and of soul. And in light of that gospel, there is this peace. Not peace about everything that's going on in the world, but peace within yourself, because you know that there's peace between you and God. And believe me, I've had days, believe me, I have been through tragedy, but I cannot even imagine going through some of the tragedy that I've been in just the last couple of years, and having to face that under the legalistic system. And if it were true that I was facing something that was real. It is a fact that kindness would be to tell them about that. But it is, as I said, just equally as unkind to warn somebody about an evil that does not exist.
This is Glenn Klein Online. Mike Williams along for the ride on this Wednesday evening. Michael, do you ever get upset with yourself that you ever believed that?
In the past, I have. I don't think that I am in that position anymore, because the thing that the gospel has done for me is to help me embrace my past as part of what brought me to understanding what I do today.
How do you do that?
Well, I don't think that you do that. I think the gospel does that, because I didn't do that. I didn't set out to try to make this work, you know, for me. I just wanted to know what the truth was, and I remember, you know, as a kid and as a Bible teacher and pastor, I remember my constant prayer was that I just wanted to know what the truth was. I didn't care what it was. And I remember, you know, we started studying in the Word of Faith movement, and they were telling us that everybody was supposed to be healthy all the time and wealthy all the time. And I remember going to into prayer and telling God, you know, I want the truth. I don't. If truth is I'm supposed to be sick all the time, then let me have it, because I knew enough about truth to know that it was freedom. And if I was supposed to be healthy and wealthy all the time, then let me have it. But if I was supposed to be sick, it didn't make any difference. Truth just has had a value to me from early on in my life, and also, goodness, I don't think I ever taught, you know, through those years without acknowledging that the Holy Spirit is the great teacher. But I didn't do anything, and I think that's the wonderful thing, is that the gospel is the power of God unto salvation.
Well, and I think that these things that we believed as Word of Faith Christians, if you will, Spirit-filled Christians, as we used to call it, they were childish, and you have to put aside childish things. And I kind of liken it to, you know, I'm not upset at myself that when I started beginning to walk, I had to crawl first, and when I stood up, I fell down and I skinned my knee and it hurt like heck. And but eventually, I learned to walk and run, and that's the process that we go through. I thank God for those times, because we're in a much better position, a more educated and experiential position to speak with intelligence about this, because we experienced it. And even though it's true, and as you said last week, truth stands on its own, we speak from where we came. We know from whence we came, and we understand where people are at, and I think we have more credibility because of it.
Yes, absolutely. And the reality of that just stands in stark contrast, and it is true, you know, the fact that we've been there, everyone's been there. And like I said, it's part of the journey. And I think also that, like, and Glenn, I've come to a really wonderful place where that I so know what my job is, if you will, which is something I couldn't stop if I wanted to, it seems as though. But, you know, it just has settled in the last year or so that even the questions that we have about tongues or not tongues, when to pray, how to pray, what to pray, health, healing, prosperity, you know, those are all perspectives. They are not the gospel. If somebody has had an experience with praying in tongues, hallelujah, go for it. If you feel that it is beneficial, do it, and do it better and more than anybody. If people are in different places with their belief system, but see, this is where that the gospel accommodates. The gospel is not there to dictate to you how you experientially involve yourself with the gospel. The gospel is here to give you foundational principles.
Right.
By which you can establish yourself on.
And then no matter what you experience, if you are established in the gospel, guilt does not ensue from that.
Absolutely, nor does judgment. But because, see, like when I was involved in the circles that I was in, I mean, you know, we did. We said we didn't think we were superior, but we were superior to people who didn't speak in tongues.
Well, for God's sake, we called it the full gospel. I mean,
it was the full gospel, and those partial gospel people were just left out. Yeah. So, but and experiencing the fullness and those things. But it is so amazing to me because I know that during a part of my walk, as I started learning the gospel, I wanted to take on all these things as issues and define them. And, you know, it just became crystal clear to me, that's none of my business. It's none of my business how someone defines whether something happened to them was healing or not healing,
right,
or they believe in healing, don't believe in healing, or God sent them a check, you know, in the mail, or didn't send them a check in the mail, or, you know, they're believing for Aunt Sally to, you know, to find her first mate, or, you know, she's 40 years old and never been married, so we're believing for Aunt Sally, you know. That's great, you know. Those things are the experiential parts that I have no say-so about. I don't have a right to question the validity of someone's experience.
Right.
My job is to preach the solid truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ.
And also not to judge people for their experiences. I liken my years in religion to my years previous to religion, where I, you know, quite frankly, experienced with quite a bit of hallucinogenic drugs. And, you know, I had some experiences, and they were interesting, and I cannot deny them. They were mind-altering. I wouldn't necessarily recommend them, though.
No.
And that's how I liken my years in religion. I cannot deny some of the wild and woolly stuff that we experience, and so I cannot deny it. I would not necessarily recommend those experiences, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. This is Glenn Klein Online, along with Mike Williams of the Gospel Revolution. We're coming to you tonight from the Glenn Klein Online studios in Tampa, Florida. Michael in Illinois, you're all over the globe, and we're receiving many emails, and we want to get your comments and questions at webcast@gospelrevolution.com. That's webcast@gospelrevolution.com. We're also asking you to participate tonight at gospelrevolution.com by ordering CD teachings, and we're looking for people to make sponsorships and donations for this webcast. $250, ladies and gentlemen. You can donate an entire webcast and dedicate it to whatever cause or event or anniversary that you'd like. Just email us at webcast@gospelrevolution.com. Say that you want to participate that way. And you can also invite Mike. We've got some questions involving these topics, Mike, and we're going to take your questions too, ladies and gentlemen, at webcast@gospelrevolution.com. Here's a question from Lisa and Bill, our friends in the Philadelphia area. Mike, they want you to discuss your explanation about the second coming of Christ being 2,000 years ago at the cross.
Ah, big subject. We could take several broadcasts of that. number one is Hebrews lays out the particulars about the second coming. And that's in Hebrews chapter 9 that we have such a beautiful articulation from, I believe, to be Paul. And Paul goes through the entire Christ involvement in the planet in this book. You can't find something that is not discussed about the participation of Jesus on this planet and the things that were resolved through his life, death, burial, and his resurrection, or any involvement that he's to have in this planet. I believe Hebrews brings it out very clearly. And Hebrews teaches that about Jesus and talks about him appearing, and the two appearances that are very important. Of course, we know that Jesus appeared here physically, but then Paul talks about the two appearances. And when I say Paul, that's because I believe that Paul wrote this book. I don't know of anyone else who would have had the literacy of the Old Covenant and the law to write this. If it wasn't Paul, I guarantee you it wasn't any of the rest of the disciples.
Why can you say it like that?
How can I say that?
Yeah.
Because none of them were trained in the law like
mm-hmm.
Paul was.
Mm-hmm.
The working knowledge of the covenants and the priesthood and the law is absolutely profound in the book of Hebrews. And we know from the Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John's description of the jobs and the related lives of the other disciples, they just were not trained in this way. So that's the reason I attribute this to Paul. But anyway, he spoke and said that Christ entered in, made this appearance for us in heaven. Let's see. It says in verse 11, and 12, but Christ, being come and high priest of good things to come, by greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is to say, not of this this building, neither by the blood of goats or calves, but by his own blood, he entered in once into the holy place, having obtained eternal redemption for us. And another place that actually uses the term that the appearance that he made, which is in Corinthians, and it talks about he made this appearance for us in heavenly places, and he appeared for us and by himself and presented us before God as righteous. Then, as he continues on in this. And tells us about this appearance. That's in verse 24 exactly. It says, for Christ is not entered in to the holy place made with hands, which are the figure of the true, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. So we have an appearance of Jesus in the presence of God. And then at the end of that, I'm not going to read all of it, but it says, it goes into, for then, verse 26 says, for then must he have often suffered since the foundation of the world, but now once at the end of the world hath he appeared to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And it is appointed unto men once to die, but after that the judgment. And you see, we quote this out of Genesis and say that that's still in effect, but if you read this in context, you'll see that Jesus is the one who kept that appointment and that appearance before God for us. So Christ was once offered to bear the sins of many, and unto them that look for him shall he appear the second time without sin unto salvation. Now, this second appearance is spoken of in Hebrews. But if this second appearance has not happened, if it has not happened, then Jesus is not without sin, and there is no salvation. So here in Hebrews, we are confronted with a second coming. a second coming, which was Christ's resurrection from the dead, talked about in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 in profound detail, which also talks about the second coming, which we'll flip over there to finish up this little explanation here. And that second coming of Christ was his appearance from the dead. Now, can I tell everybody that there is nothing of another coming of Jesus? You know, Jesus can do whatever he wants to do. I mean, he can show up, you know, anywhere he wants, anytime he wants. Mike Williams' teachings are not going to prevent him from doing anything. But it is my job as a teacher to focus on the work of Christ that has already been accomplished. And I can tell you there has been a second coming, and that has been profoundly done, talked about also by Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. And 1 Thessalonians also speaks about this, about the that we will not all sleep, but we shall be changed in the moment, in the twinkling of an eye. And you see, we read that one in Thessalonians, and it sounds futuristic. But Paul, the thing we have to remember is that Paul always spoke. Paul even spoke of the cross in a futuristic terms to those who did not yet understand. Paul's teaching style is very unique and it's very powerful. It's not an unknown form of teaching, but it is a very high form of teaching in which you engage the person from where they are, not engage them from where the teacher is. Paul's teachings engaged the people from where they were, and he engaged them from that point. So here we are talking about this incredible subject, and in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 he says, "Behold, I show you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall be changed in the moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the sound of the trump, of the last trump." So where 2 Thessalonians talks about this being changed in the twinkling of an eye and this second coming, it does speak of it in those terms, but it doesn't give us a timeline for it. Now, to find timelines, you have to go to the prophets. You can't go to modern-day Bible teachers. You have to go to the prophets. And the law of the Psalms and the prophets, which is what Jesus and Paul and James and John all recommended that we do. And when you study the term of the last trump, you find that the last trump, because even Corinthians or Hebrews says, we have not come to the sound of a trump anymore. So if we are no longer those who come to the sound of a trump, which was one of them was a sound of judgment for sure, then the last trump is not something that is yet to come, because Hebrews says that we are not come to the sound of a trump, nor the voice of words, nor this dark cloud of judgment hanging over us. So the last trump, he says, shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible. Now, this sounds futuristic, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But you see, we've got to back up and see what the dead being raised is talking about here. And he says in verse, oh goodness, it's so hard. This is all so good. We only have an hour. Let me try to start at verse 45. We were down in verse 51 and 52. So we've learned that at the last trump, the dead shall be raised incorruptible, because that is another second coming issue, that's what's going to happen at the second coming. He says in verse 45, backing up just a bit in 1 Corinthians 15, he says, "And so it is written, the first man, Adam, was made a living soul, and the last Adam was a quickening spirit. Howbeit, that was not first which was spiritual, but that which was natural, and after that, that which is spiritual. The first man is of the earth, earthly, and the second man is the Lord from heaven. And as is the earthly, such are they also that are earthy, and as so is the heaven, so is they that are heavenly." And it says that we also will put on this heavenly. But you see, the context is that we put this on in the same way that sin was put upon the first Adam, that the first man, Adam, and the entire process of the first Adam and the results coming from that was death, spiritual death, we would call it. And he says, but the last Adam was a quickening spirit. Now, he's not a quickening spirit that is still quickening spirits, because Adam didn't have to do another thing to drag everybody else into sin.
Right.
This is not a progressive thing that he's talking about. So the question is, have the dead already been raised incorruptible? Well, we'll just have to read just a little bit further to find out. And says, and shall be changed. Sounds futuristic, doesn't it? Again, let's see how futuristic it is. For this corruptible must put on incorruption, and this mortality, this mortal must put on immortality. So when this corruptible shall have put on incorruption, and this mortal shall have put on immortality, then shall be brought to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is thy sting? O grave, where is thy victory? The sting of death is sin, and the strength of sin is the law. So you see, the last trump, the raising from the dead, and this being caught up in the twinkling of an eye, and all being made one with God, was done at the same time that the law and death were dealt with, and that was the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. As he says in the following verse in 57, but thanks be to God which giveth us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. So here we have this incredible picture, and I have one series of tapes called The Last Trump. It's got six tapes in it that we went through every reason in the Old Testament, because we were instructed to by Jesus and Paul and James and John and all those good guys to go back and search these things out through the scriptures. So, Glenn, I did. I went back and I searched through the scriptures, through the law and the Psalms and the prophets, the things that the trumpet was used for. I found 25. There are more. But every one of those trumpets were significant in types and shadows of what was fulfilled at the cross, including the judgment of God, which was the sound of the trumpet. Whether it made one long blast or intervals or, it was like a Morse code through the trumpet, actually, is what it was. And the people knew the sound of this trumpet. That's the reason Paul said, if the trumpet doesn't give a clear sound, how will the people know what to do, when he was talking in also in Corinthians. And we went through and studied all of those, and the people came, the sound of the trump for the Feast of Tabernacles, to bring their tithes. The sound of the trumpet for the gathering in, for everything. And every one of those things are clearly able to be taught as fulfilled at the cross. And this, where Paul says, the last trump. Now, we did a study also, let me throw this in there, because it's part of the picture, because Revelation teaches about the last trump and also about the last vial. That would be poured out upon the human race, the last vial of God's wrath. The last trump was the one that would signify the final judgment. The last vial was the one that would signify, would be full of God's wrath. Now, when it says the last vial, or the final vial that was to be poured out upon the earth, that term vial there is the same term throughout the Bible as it means a cup. That's all it really means. So if you look through the Old Testament, it constantly is talking about the cup of God's wrath that is it's filled with the dregs of the wrath of God. The wrath of God he says, you will drink this cup. He tells the planet, you will drink the cup of God's wrath.
Yeah, now, so what about that?
Fast forward to a place called the Garden of Gethsemane. Now, I believe that the Word was made flesh, and that you cannot translate anything in the Old Testament without running it through the life, death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. It's all about Jesus. So when God was speaking, oh gosh, Glenn, it's so beautiful. when God was speaking to the human race and telling them, you will drink the full cup of the dregs of the wrath of God. And then here Jesus is getting ready to go to the cross. Now, you remember his prayer? Father, if there is any way possible, let this cup pass from me. Mm. Now, Glenn, there is no other cup. Mm. There is no other scriptural cup other than the cup of the dregs of the wrath of God that was prepared for the human race. And he said, God, and Jesus knew what this wrath was. Jesus, oh, this is so beautiful. I hope our listeners are enjoying this as much as I am right now. But get the picture, folks. The last trump sounded, and the cup was handed not to the human race. It didn't pour out on the human race, as the book of Revelation says. John saw it taking place because he watched that history fulfilled while he was watching Jesus die on the cross and then pen this revelation on the Isle of Patmos some years later. But here we see Jesus, and God has this last vial of wrath that is to be poured out upon the earth. And the moment that he did, Jesus is in the, and while that cup is being brought down to the earth to be poured out, Jesus is in the Garden of Gethsemane. Jesus is there in the garden. He sees that cup being placed to his lips. And what does he pray? Oh, Father, if there is any way, please let this cup pass from me. But remember what he said? But Father, not my will, but thine be done.
Awesome. It's Glenn Klein online with Mike Williams. Thank you so much, Lisa and Bill, for your question. And like Mike said, there's an entire teaching about that at the Gospel Revolution website. And that's entitled, again, Michael?
The one on the, goodness, there's so many out there.
No, the Trump.
The last Trump. There are 6 tapes on just the last Trump. Now, yeah. we don't have any of the other stuff in the last Trump about the last vial, but that's in a tape somewhere. We're getting more organized, folks. We'll be able to disseminate the information to you more accurately is where it is.
A lot more questions to get to. Mike, this comes from another Bill. He said he wanted you to address the issue of 2 Thessalonians 1:5-10. He said the scripture was written by Paul, the same apostle that you based the rest of your theology on. He says, I know Paul says we do not struggle against flesh and blood, and was wondering who he is referring to here. Also in chapter 2, verses 5-12, he refers to the lawless one. He says he believes here and other places it refers to the Greek as a man or a human being. Later on in Revelations, the Antichrist is thrown into the lake of fire. How can this be if all are redeemed?
Well, there again, and of course, we're in 1 and 2 Thessalonians, and I do put question as to Paul's teaching. I'm not the only one who questions whether 1 and 2 Thessalonians are the teachings of Paul. There just aren't any of the earmarks of the teachings of Paul. That's irrelevant at this point. We'll take it that these are Paul's teachings. And again, you have to remember that Paul taught that which is already past in a futuristic text. He even spoke about the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus in a futuristic text to those who did not yet understand that, such as in the book of Hebrews, he addressed people who were wanting to go back under the law, and he spoke to them in the context of what the law actually was. He addressed people from where they are. I do cite Paul's teachings, but let me also be very clear about this. I do not look for doctrinal truth in the New Testament.
Why not?
Because Jesus did not instruct me to look for gospel truth in the New Testament. Neither did Paul, neither did James, neither did John. Jesus said, you do err not knowing the Scriptures. Now, 1 Thessalonians was not written when Jesus said that.
Right. When you're talking about the New Testament, you're not talking about the actual New Testament of the blood of Christ. You're talking, you're talking about the writings that we call the New Testament.
Yes, the writings of the New Testament, not the covenant of the New Testament. But so when we go back to try to validate truth, we do not validate it. I can study in Paul's teachings. I can study in John's, James. I can study anywhere. But you see, my job and everyone's job is to validate all of these teachings by the law, the Psalms, and the prophets. And when I went back, it's just like, that's the reason I went back and I was able to read and get through the issue of the believing issue and see that John's requirement to believe resulted in such a beautiful revelation that nobody would ever, that it was prophesied, that nobody would believe. But you see, I have to go back to the law, the Psalms, and the prophets. And here is the thing. There is no prophet, regardless of what Peter, James, John, Paul, or anybody said, there is no prophet who foretold of a partial redemption that would take place. Not one single prophecy said that Jesus would come and do a partial work and then delay that and then finish it up sometime in the future. There is no prophecy there. So my job is to honor the law, the Psalms, and the prophets instructed by Jesus Christ himself. That's what Paul was instructed to do. That's what Peter and James and John were instructed to do. That's where they wrote from to the best of their knowledge of understanding. You see, we have taught the entire world that the writings of Peter, James, and John, I do not believe that Paul's writing is Scripture. I teach from it because I can see that it validates what the prophets foretold. And do I disagree with some of the teachings that are in James and John? Yes, I do. Because it disagrees with what the prophets said would happen in. And actually, there's some places that I actually enjoy going in and teaching out of the book of James and 1st and 2nd Peter because I can find validation with what the prophets said. But again, this is, if Paul himself were to start saying that there was something that was not fulfilled at the cross, I would have to question Paul's teaching. You'd have to question mine. You'd have to question Peter, James, John, the Pope. It doesn't make any difference to the first, the Southern Baptist Convention, the Catholic Church, because we must get back to what Jesus said is the place where we validate. I'm not discrediting these writings. They're powerful writings, and as Bill pointed out, I use these writings to teach from. But don't get me wrong. I do not use these writings to validate truth. I use these writings because I find that they have agreed with the truth that has been validated by the law, the Psalms, and the prophets.
This segues nicely into our next question from Edmonton, from Stuart. He says, do you see a validity, Michael, in New Testament writings outside of the Gospel and Paul's?
Oh, absolutely. In all of them, there's great validity. But again, you see, even Paul's writings, it doesn't make any difference whose they are. Again, we must, this is not a church commandment. This is instructions from Jesus when it comes to studying to understand truth. He said, you do err because you do not know the Scriptures. Now, I don't know if the series is still available or not, but we also did a 6-tape series called The Scriptures. And I hope that that's still available. I'm not sure if it is or not. But we went into finite detail, and I taught over 6 hours. We took every verse in the New Testament. You know, there's no place in the New Testament in Paul's, Peter, James, or John's writings that says, "Thus saith the Lord." Because they knew that it wasn't "Thus saith the Lord." And even Paul said, you know, now I'm writing to you with the best wisdom that I think that I have from God. And he even said, this is my opinion. And he said, I left my coat. You know, I'm cold. Bring it to me when you get here.
Thus saith the Lord.
Yes.
Bring me my coat. I'm freezing my tuchus off.
You know, these are the things we have to look at. Paul disagreed with me. You say, Mike Williams, how dare you say you disagree with Peter, James, and John? Well, Peter, James, and John disagreed with Paul, and Paul disagreed with Peter, James, and John.
Well, that's okay for them to disagree, Michael, but who the heck are you?
Well, I'm nobody. That's the reason I have to go to the source that Jesus said we all have to go to. The law, the Psalms, and the prophets are where we validate truth. And I challenge anyone to find a partial redemption foretold by the prophets in the prophecies of Isaiah.
That is such an awesome point. There's nowhere in there that says the Messiah is going to come out of Zion to give you a chance.
To give you a chance. There is no chance redemption. There is no option redemption. It says that he would redeem all of Israel and all the heathen, and it would go to the uttermost islands of the earth, and that nothing would escape the redemptive power of the work of the cross.
All Israel and the Gentiles. There ain't anybody else.
There ain't nobody else in God's eyes.
Well, we're coming against our time here. We're going to extend a few minutes later to get all of our questions in, and again, encouraging you to go, not only now, but throughout the week, to gospelrevolution.com and order the CDs and make donations and invite Mike. But I want to get to a few of these last questions. Mike, this comes from Stacy. She says, Michael, thank you for standing up for the truth of the gospel. Your message has set my heart free from legalism and judgment that had alienated me from my sisters and mother. That is so awesome. My heart is definitely being established in grace. Would you address the verse in Romans 6 that says, what shall we say then? Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? And that whole section.
Okay, first off, you can't start trying to understand Romans chapter 6 until you've understood Romans chapter 5, of course. And of course, you know my thing, and of course I'm not saying this to Stacy, but we... anytime we had questions that were, you know, single verse that were trying to prove a point, which I know that Stacy's just asking a question here, but when somebody uses a verse to try to prove a point, I'd say, well, we see your verse and raise you a chapter here. So, but I'm a chapter man. At least if you're going to believe something, you know, let it be within context. Number one, the term sin in the book of Romans shows up about 42, 43 times. There are two parts of speech for the word sin in the book of Romans, and one is a noun and one is a verb. You'll find that in your Vines, which breaks these things down into parts of speech. And the book of Romans deals with sin a great deal. But the issue is that of the 43 times that the word sin shows up in the New Testament, and of the times that it shows up as a noun and a verb. Of course, now let us have a third grade teaching here on English just a moment. A noun is not an action. It's a person, place, or thing. And a verb is an action. It is something you do. And when the word sin shows up in the book of Romans these 43 times, one time in the entire book of Romans does it show up as a verb, as addressing man's actions and deeds. So the book of Romans is not dealing with man's actions. It's dealing with man's condition, the condition brought on by the first Adam, which is very clear by the teaching in Romans chapter 5, which it says, therefore, in verse 17 of chapter 5, therefore, if by the offense of one man death reigned by one much more. They which receive an abundance of grace and the gift of righteousness shall reign in life. Therefore, by the offense of one, judgment came upon all men to condemnation. Even so, by the righteousness of one, the free gift came upon all men unto justification. How can we confuse that? It's so amazing. Continuing to read, though. For as by one man's disobedience many were made sinners, so by the obedience of one shall many be made righteous. See, Paul speaks that almost in futuristic terms, but we know that the conclusion is that all were made righteous by the same comparison.
Yeah, a better translation for that word many would be all.
It is all. Moreover, the law entered that the offense might abound. So the offense was here before the law ever got here. But where sin abounded, the condition of sin abounded, and it abounded under the law. Grace did much more abound. You know, we've got to bring the context of grace in here. But see, it's grace compared not to man's actions and deeds, but his condition. The condition of sin abounded because the law came, but grace did much more abound, that as sin hath reigned unto death. So he's saying sin does not reign anymore. The condition of sin does not reign anymore. Even so might grace reign through righteousness unto eternal life by Jesus Christ. What shall we say then? Shall we continue in the condition of sin that grace may abound? Because, see, the comparison before was not about man's actions and deeds. It was about the introduction of grace applied to the condition of sin. And what Paul is saying here is, God forbid, how shall we that are dead to sin, we are dead to the condition of sin, live any longer therein? You see?
It's a mindset, isn't it?
It is a total mindset.
And that's where salvation occurs. The Bible calls it the renewing of the mind. So this reality that we are not living in sin anymore.
Absolutely. And continuing on down just a few verses from that, he says, knowing this, that our old man is crucified with him, that the body of sin might be destroyed, not manipulated, not controlled, not held in check, destroyed, that henceforth we should not serve sin. How do you not serve sin? By not doing wrong? No, you do not serve sin by not being in a condition of sin anymore, ruled by the law, which was there to exacerbate the condition of sin. Now, if we be dead with Christ, we believe that we shall also live with him. For he that is dead is freed from sin. So the issue here is you can't live in sin anymore. Should we continue to live in sin that grace abounds? God forbid. But see, that's the message we're trying to get across to the church, Glenn, is that they're still preaching the condition of sin.
Right.
And Paul said, should we continue in that condition just because grace has come along? No, because grace eliminates the condition. It totally eliminates the condition. It doesn't modify the condition. And this is the difference between what we're saying about the gospel and what the church is saying about the gospel. We are saying that the work of the cross was complete, total, and that it was not anemic, it was not something that was a part work and handed out incrementally.
I like that. It was not anemic. In other words, it was not without blood.
That's
an awesome, awesome thought.
Absolutely. So here we are sharing this gospel, and we're saying, we're answering the same question, but in Paul's context. Paul's concern was not with man's actions and deeds. He was concerned about man understanding that the condition of sin has been dealt with. Should we continue in sin? And see, the church is continuing people in sin and then preaching some grace to redeem it or to relieve it or to alter it. Please hear me. The grace and mercy of God did not come to massage sin. It did not come to appease sin. It came to destroy the sin nature as far as relationship to God. It is dead. It does not exist. So should we serve sin any longer? God forbid. How can we that are dead to sin possibly live therein anymore?
That's a great way to conclude tonight, ladies and gentlemen. We've got another question from Bill that we will get to on the subject of the Trinity, Michael, next time when we meet on the Glenn Klein Online webcast. Michael, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure.
We're going to take next week off because I will be in the great North Woods at a speaking engagement, and we're going to do this frequently, and we're committed to it, and we hope you will commit to it by going to gospelrevolution.com and making a donation. Do your best, ladies and gentlemen, this week. We really need your help. $250 will allow you to sponsor and dedicate an entire webcast, and we're also looking for somebody to donate $50 a month so we can get some more phone lines and equipment in here so we can take your phone calls. We'd like to hear from you in person. And any final words on this particular Wednesday night, Michael?
Well, just thank you all, to all those that have joined in. You know, again, we've been looking for a way to get everybody together. And for the moment, let's continue to enjoy this, folks. I sit here as I'm on the phone, and I'm picturing you guys in Nova Scotia and in New Jersey and Canada and Australia and California and in Mobile, Alabama. And my goodness, my mind just races to each and every one of you with love and with compassion and respect. And thank you for what you've done. Thank you for embracing the gospel. You made my day.
Well, you know, in closing, we got an email just now from Faye, and she was wondering if there's a network of believers where we can make contact out there in real life. And she says she misses the fellowship that she had in the church with like-minded believers. She says the webcast will certainly be beneficial in relieving some of this loneliness, but it would be so great to know someone out there to fellowship with. Well, Faye, you've got some people here literally all over the globe, and as you said, Michael, let's stay with this, see where it takes us. One of the ways that you can experience this together is to have Michael come and visit your area, and you're very willing to go, and you have gone all over the planet, Michael, even with small groups. Tom writes and says that he's been listening to your tapes, and he's keeping up with what the Lord is saying through you. He says it's given him so much joy and growth, enough where he'd like to advertise in their local newspaper and then rent a space at a convention hall and invite all that would like to come and hear the gospel.
Awesome.
That's what we're talking about.
That's what we're talking about.
And it can,
or just your living room, you know. If you got a living room where, you know, 10, 15, 20 people can sit, you know, it's an airfare and my food.
The series that's on the website, the Redemption of the World series, which was a 3-tape series, was done in my living room here in Tampa.
It sure was.
Yeah, it was one of the most powerful teachings.
All over the world.
And it's so exciting to know that that has and that this is. So our next webcast, ladies and gentlemen, is scheduled for 2 weeks from tonight. That will be Wednesday, October 25th.
Yes, and email us and tell us what you think about the broadcast. It's encouraging.
And so we'll get to John's question about the Trinity at that time and your questions here on the Glenn Klein online webcast. Michael, thanks again so much. Have a great week. We love you. And this is Glenn Klein saying, Shalom, everybody.